The research and information that we report during today's broadcast was supported by the National Institute on Minority Health and Health Disparities of the National Institutes of Health under award number 5U54MD00860802. The content is solely the responsibility of the authors and does not necessarily represent the official views of the National Institutes of Health.
Want to make a change for once in my life.
Welcome to Make the Change, your weekly dose of inspiration for creating positive change in your life. Learn how changing your thoughts, feelings, words, and actions can lead to the life you desire and deserve. No need to go it alone. Let us become part of your journey to get from where you are to where you want to be. Every Saturday at noon, the show's host, Patricia Terrell, and her fabulous guests will lead you with a weekly prescription to invigorate your mind, body, and soul. Wait not a minute more. It's time to get started with Make the Change.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to another live broadcast of Make the Change radio show. I am your host, Patricia Terrell, and I want to thank you for tuning in today. And as always, the call-in number for the show is 1-800-450-7876. Today's show is sponsored by the Health Policy Research Consortium, whose mission is to inform the public about public policy, how public policy can improve our health, and what each of us can do to drive public policy decisions to make our communities healthier. Today, we're talking about environmental justice. In many places around the country, there is growing concern about the health effects of environmental hazards, from lead in the water to nitrogen dioxide in the air. These hazardous toxins can turn our communities into death traps. And there is plenty of evidence that these dangers are not equally borne by all populations. Byron Soji Thomas with Health Policy Research Consortium, also known as HPRC, is in the studio with me today to discuss the role of public policy in preventing or correcting environmental hazards and improving our health. I am also joined by a local community group led by Kamita Gray and Al Weaver, who are using community engagement to drive public policy in their fight with a very large environmental hazard, namely emissions from not one, but a third fossil fuel plant in a predominantly African-American community in Prince George's County, Maryland. Also joining me is Neil Gormley with Earth Justice in Washington, D.C., and he's going to talk about this entire issue of environmental justice and what we can do to protect our communities from these environmental hazards. Welcome to the show, everyone.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Okay. So we have a lot to cover. So let's start with you, Byron Soji Thomas, as the Deputy Director for Health Policy Research and Analysis at HPRC. What does HPRC want us to know about the environmental hazards that pollute our water, our air, and soil? And what can we do to protect our health and communities?
Well, thank you again, Patricia, for inviting us here. And thank you for this very timely discussion. Given what has happened in the nation, even in the last 48 hours or so. Pollution can be controlled, but unfortunately many times we don't get a good enough handle on it. So as you said, there are toxins that can pollute the air, there are toxins that can pollute the soil, there are toxins that can pollute the water, and the pollution can enter our bodies through our skin, they can enter our bodies through our lungs, they can enter our bodies through our eyes and our ears, and therefore they can impact the body at multiple levels. Different organs can be impacted. One organ, maybe through the lungs, your pulmonary system, maybe your heart, your circulatory system, maybe your brain, the central nervous system. So multiple organ systems can be impacted by pollution. One single pollutant can cause trouble in multiple organ systems. So there are health effects that pollution causes that we are desperately in need of controlling at every level where we can. And it so happens that power plants, for example, emit about one-third of the carbon dioxide that we have in the air here in America. So this is a key place to go if we want to reduce carbon dioxide emissions, because they can cause all kinds of health problems. In fact, the problems are so grave and the problems so intense that we now have a federal plan called the Clean Power Plan, which unfortunately is now tied up in the courts because there are many interests who think that the Clean Power Plan is overly ambitious. But the idea behind the plan is that you would curtail the amount of emissions from power plants so that by 2030, we would have reduced about 30% of those emissions at least. And so that if we do that, then the plan estimates that we would avoid anywhere from 1,500 to 3,600 premature deaths, from anywhere from 90,000 or so asthma attacks in children, 1,700 heart attacks in adults, 1,700 hospital admissions, 300,000 missed school and work days. And if this plan is implemented the way the plan sets it out, the cost for implementation would be, the federal government estimates, somewhere about $8.4 billion. But the savings in public health and climate benefits would range anywhere from $34 billion to $54 billion per year by 2030. Power plants, unfortunately, are not the only place where these pollutants can come from. They can come from our car exhaust fumes. They can come from incinerators. They can come from landfills, toxic waste dumps. They can come from industrial installations. They can come from any improper dumping of industrial waste. So there are many places we can go, but here today, we're going to spend a lot of the time talking about what pollution power plants can cause.
Yeah, and there's so many. And like you mentioned, this is so timely considering what's going on with North Dakota. So I would like to bring Neil Gormley in right now. Neil, you're the senior associate attorney with Earth Justice in Washington, D.C. And I have to admit, prior to the show, I never heard of the term environmental justice. Tell us what it means.
Well, environmental justice is a really powerful principle, and it's the kind of thing, like so many important principles, that can mean different things to many people. But I think that at its heart, it's the idea that environmental burdens and environmental benefits shouldn't be unequally distributed. There shouldn't be discrimination or bias in who suffers from environmental problems and who has the benefits of green space and clean air and clean water and all of the things that we should be entitled to in our environment. So I think that's really at the core of it. It is that there shouldn't be discrimination in environmental outcomes and in environmental decision making.
And so let me just expand upon that a little bit, because we have several national cases in the news where people have organized to fight for environmental justice in their communities. Of course, most recently with the Native American Indians in North Dakota. But we also have the soil issue in East Chicago and also the water issue in Flint, Michigan, just to name a few. So it's not me that I take it. I take it your findings reflect that vulnerable populations discrimination is occurring, and vulnerable populations are receiving disproportionate exposure to environmental hazards. Is that true? Is that what your findings indicate?
We see it. We see it all around the country, and we see it in all different areas. Across all different types of environmental issues, we see the same pattern playing out, where communities of color and low-income communities, as you mentioned, Native American communities, are not receiving their fair share of environmental benefits, and they're bearing an unfair burden in terms of environmental harms. To go back to what Byron was saying, we really do see that. One example is power plants. The NAACP put out a report several years ago called Coal-Blooded, which I think really helped to, add momentum to the discussion around environmental justice, showing just how much more likely the community around a coal-fired power plant is to be African American, how those communities are disproportionately African American, where coal-fired power plants are being sited. And now, you know, in the case that I'm working on with Al and Kamita, we're seeing the same phenomenon in other types of power plants, like the new gas-fired power plant that is being proposed in Brandywine.
And so let me ask you this, with that, with your findings, why is it that these environmental hazards are being placed in these communities? Is it because these are more rural areas, they have more land to accommodate these power plants and other hazards? Why is that happening?
I think that's the million-dollar question. You know, what we know is that it's happening, that it's happening across issues, that it's happening all across the country. It's not just because they're rural areas. You know, many people of color live in urban communities and still are more likely to be near toxic sites and sources of toxic pollution. So I think it's pretty hard to deny that that power dynamics and issues of privilege and race play in to the outcomes that we see.
Yes, and also we do have another issue, and I don't know if this applies, but you can definitely correct me if I'm wrong, this whole issue of fracking, which will affect all communities, which is what we saw in Oklahoma with the earthquake. They're attributing maybe that fracking to that earthquake. Is that an environmental issue that Earth Justice is concerned about?
Earth Justice has done a lot of work on fracking as well. We represented communities in New York who were concerned about fracking in their backyards, and the town of Dryden changed its local ordinances to limit, you know, to essentially prohibit fracking within their town, and the fracking industry argued that was illegal, that communities didn't have that power. Earth Justice served as attorneys helping to defend that local law, and we're victorious in the Supreme Court of New York.
And why don't you tell us briefly exactly what is fracking for our listeners?
Fracking is an unusually destructive method of extracting oil and gas from underground. It stands for hydraulic fracturing, and the process basically involves injecting water mixed with chemicals and sand and other things actually that the companies don't disclose, injecting it at high pressure deep underground to break up the rock and then allow gas and oil to escape once the rock is broken up. You know, it's a relatively new phenomenon. You know, fracking is a technique that has really been embraced in the last 5 to 10 years, and we're still learning, really, about the damage that it can do. New science is coming in every day about the effects on water, about the effects in terms of air pollution, and, as you mentioned, in terms of earthquakes.
Okay. So this brings me back to public policy. So, Byron, what do we need to know about how public policy can help prevent some of these very issues that we're talking about right now?
Well, thanks for the question. Neil has just been alluding to it, and he's beginning to create a frame for us to understand how public policy plays a role. The first thing is for communities that might be impacted by any of this to first of all be aware. That's the first thing that needs to happen. The community needs to be aware that this is coming. They need to be aware of where the decisions will be made. In the case of siting a power plant, for example, in your community, there's probably going to be some kind of a public service commission. There probably is in your state some kind of office of environmental quality. In your county or in your city, there's probably some kind of city council or county council function for assessing the environmental impact of whatever you're going to place, whether it's a new industry or a new power plant. And the community needs to understand, first, this is what's coming. Second, these are the potential impacts on your health. Third, this is where the decision is likely to be made. Fourth, this is the time horizon that we have to influence what would happen. And once the decisions are made and people begin to write laws and regulation about how to govern this, then the community still needs to keep abreast of what's going on all through the construction process. And if there are any problems that arise then, communities still need to be engaged with, okay, well, what do we do if along the way during construction there's something that happens that could be harmful? Who do we go to? Who's the decision maker? Is it at that point that you can take legal action and call somebody like an Earth Justice to help? And all through the process, and even after the plant or the industry or whatever is creating the pollution is already up and running and in use, there is a need to keep up with how much assessment is done about how much pollution is being emitted in the air on a regular and periodic basis. We'll talk more as we go, as we hear the story that Neil and company will be telling.
Absolutely, and that's a very timely segue, because now many people do not believe that they can fight or win against anything, against big government and big businesses. And so many people either opt not to do anything, or they're simply not aware of it, because I understand that some of these decisions are not made with the community's involvement. And so we want to talk about community engagement in driving public policy when it comes to protecting our environment at the local level where we live. And we have a good example here in Brandywine, Maryland. And so let's go ahead and talk about that group with Kamita Gray and Al Weaver. Kamita and Al, your organization, the Brandywine TB Southern Region Neighborhood Coalition, filed a federal civil rights complaint to fight the state of Maryland's approval of not one, but a third fossil fuel plant in your community. So, Kamita Gray, tell us what alarmed you the most about having another power plant in your community? What is the issue?
The issue was in our thinking that we couldn't even fathom that saying that a third power plant was feasible. What really got to me was there was no HIAs, which is a health assessment, or no environmental assessments done within a community that is already impacted by other pollution sources in the Brandywine area. The other thing is, in the finding, they found that Brandywine, or they said that Brandywine is unfortunate, and notes that the negative impacts of the plant most severely falls on Brandywine, while the benefit is distributed across a much larger geographical area. So for us, we interpret that, well, we know it's going to be a concentration of pollution, but it's for the greater good of the community, so, we'll just put that over there with in the Brandywine area without a thought of how it's going to affect the urban community.
I just want to make sure I heard you correctly, and I think I heard you say that maybe a local organization indicated that, sorry, but Brandywine is going to have to bear the brunt of this for the sake or the benefit of the greater community. Is that what I heard?
It's not actually a group. It's actually in the PSC's approval of the third power plant for Brandywine.
The Public Service Commission.
Yes.
So let me go back and make sure I understand, too. There was no health impact study done, nor any community involvement on the front end.
No.
Neil, what's wrong with... Go ahead, Kamita.
There's one little thing that we have to be aware, and when we were talking before, HPRC, about community involvement and community engagement. There wasn't any community engagement, and that there were two power plants being simultaneously approved at the same time. The laws in Maryland only require that they notify abutting properties. So if it's across the street, it's not abutting, and that's the problem with these two power plants, is that the residents are across the street. So how we found out a lot of stuff was from Charles County and not from any notification by the state of Maryland or Prince George's County.
This doesn't really seem right to me. Maybe I'm missing something. Neil, can you elaborate further about why a health impact assessment was not done to to deal with the effect that it could have on residents. Can you help us to put that puzzle piece together?
Well, a lot of corners were cut in the approval of this power plant. There's really no other way to say it. You know, there was a lot of pressure from the company, and the state agencies decided to expedite the process. The only notice to the community, you know, aside from, as Kamita mentioned, mentioning it to people who literally abut the property where the power plant is going to go, was that an advertisement ran in a newspaper that the Public Service Commission acknowledges is not read in Prince George's County widely at all. And it ran only 4 days before the deadline for intervening in the proceeding. So essentially, the community had no chance to get involved, to inform themselves, and to have a say in this decision. You know, that's why we filed this complaint, because that is absolutely unacceptable.
Absolutely. And so, therefore, you had a short period of time to organize and involve yourself in community engagement. So, Al, tell me about the process that you guys went through to engage the community to take action.
I have a coffee club, the district police district 2 coffee club in our county, and I actually went through to talk to my constituents in the coffee club, and they were very, very interested about this, and then from there I said, okay, I've gauged interest here. Let me connect with Kamita. I connected with Kamita, and we went through the community. We knocked doors with help from the Sierra Club and let people know, and people just didn't know what was going on. And one of the things that I noticed, you had that in terms of demographic, you had a senior population, and then you had an extremely young population, and then you had, we found there's a non-English speaking Hispanic population that has populated that area now, and we know they weren't notified. So we, in doing that, we realized that, wow, this is when community finds out, and they you know, when the community found out, they were really outraged. But we also found out that a lot of people, it's another thing to deal with our traffic down that way, but they couldn't make the meetings because of the traffic patterns and things that run in that area. It's so egregious, some of the things that are going on down there, that they couldn't make a meeting on time if it was a meeting at 7. So we were also not only knocking the doors, but we also have become the voice of getting the information to them now. Now we're the conduit for that. And so now we're noticing the community is coming together. It's becoming a lot closer now, and phone calls are being made from neighbor to neighbor, and Kamita has just been on the forefront of this. She has just been on the front line of this, and she's really been excellent in talking to this. This is her community, you know, 54 years there, and when you're you know, one of the things when you're organizing, we're like the mailman. You know, if it's raining, we're out there. If it's sunny, 90 degrees, we're out there. You know, if we have to get that word out on that issue, that's what we have to do. Or let them keep them up to date, that's what we have to do.
Well, you know, and this is really interesting because, Byron, we're talking about public policy, being able to organize the community to take action against these very types of issues. But how can we take actions when everything is being done at stealth mode level?
Yeah, that's a problem, and unfortunately, this is not necessarily unique. And a lot of times, when you hear these stories about how a community is trying to address an environmental crisis, you find out when you go back, the community members will tell you that we didn't know. We just went about living our lives, and we didn't know this was going on. And unfortunately, that really is where this all begins. There's no way to correct these problems if you don't know that there's a problem. And there was a lead contamination crisis in the District of Columbia within the last decade or so, where the water was contaminated by lead. And after the worst of the crisis was over, the city did a retroactive. They asked Eric Holder to do a review of how this could have happened and what kind of recommendations to make sure it doesn't happen again. And, you know, there were a couple recommendations that they made about making sure that the compliance from the Environmental and Protection Agency required to make sure that the water quality stays up. There should be somebody assigned the specific responsibility to keep up with that. In the district, that was not clear. Another recommendation was, you know, there should be a free flow of information so that people know what's going on with the water quality. Every part of the city infrastructure that should take a look at this and control this, they should all know what's going on with the quality. It shouldn't just sit in one place where the information is siloed. That the public education should continue and it shouldn't stop. And when they did a similar thing in Flint after this crisis blew up, and the government said, well, what kinds of things can we learn to make sure that this doesn't happen again to help fix the problem? And part of the failure of leadership was that leadership wasn't making sure that the word was getting out. And there were any number of reasons why they were doing that. They had to restore the public trust because now the public felt, well, we didn't know. Nobody told us. And now anything you tell us, we're going to be suspicious. So that trust has to be restored. And then on the public health side, more things with screening children and adults to make sure this, whatever this toxin is that you're concerned about, can you find it in somebody's blood? Creating a cabinet level post for public health to take care of these issues, creating endowment funds to do whatever your regular funding for this doesn't cover, wherever your funding stops, have some kind of an endowment to pick up the slack, and things like that. They increase the capacity of the workforce that deals with this. So these are all things that can happen, but really it all begins with making sure the community knows. And if the community doesn't know, unfortunately, there's nothing we can do, and that's really part of the challenge.
Okay, and Neil, we have about maybe a minute or so. Why don't you contribute to how we can address these issues when they are operating on stealth mode? How do we work through this?
Well, Title VI of the Civil Rights Act offers communities, one option, one mode of recourse. Title VI requires that that any entity that receives federal funds not take actions that discriminate on the basis of race, including that have the result of causing a disparate impact on the basis of race. And so communities can file complaints with the federal agencies that provide the funding. Perhaps it's a state agency, as in our case, that receives the funding. Maybe it's a private company. But federal agencies have an obligation to cut off that funding if there's discrimination happening. So we know that our complaint is being taken seriously. We would like to see more rapid progress, because justice delayed can be justice denied. But that's a recourse that communities have as well.
Okay, and we're going to come back on the second half of the show to talk about that further. So this is Patricia Terrell with Make the Change. We're talking about environmental justice and what you can do as a community to impact your community's health. We'll be right back.
If you live in Prince George's County, Maryland, listen up for this important announcement about how you can gain access to resources that can improve your health. The Health Policy Research Consortium, also known as HPRC, has a mobile app called Health Connect Prince George's that can help you find local resources such as farmers markets, parks and hike trails, recreation centers, community health centers, hospitals, pharmacies, and much more. The Health Connect Prince George's app is available for download on Google Play and the iTunes App Store. You can also visit www.hprc.info. That's www.hprc.info, and click the links at the bottom of the page. Download the Health Connect app today to connect you and your community to a healthier tomorrow.
Welcome back to Make the Change Radio Show. This is Patricia Terrell, and we're talking about environmental justice today. And I'm joined by HPRC, Byron Soji Thomas, Neil Gormley with Earth Justice, Kamita Gray and Al Weaver with the Brandywine TB Southern Region Neighborhood Coalition. And we want to open up the second half of the show for callers. I mean, I'm sure some of you have some issues, environmental issues that you may have questions about, and now's the time to call in, 1-800-450-7876, and maybe we can help get you in the right direction regarding how to address the environmental hazards in your community. And before we do this, Neil, let's bring you back. You were talking about Title VI. And would Title VI be a civil rights issue?
Absolutely, yeah. Title VI is part of the Civil Rights Act, and it prohibits discrimination on the basis of race, color, or national origin. So when you file a Title VI complaint, you document what is the problem that the community or the individuals are experiencing, and in the cases that I do, those are environmental problems. But the other component to the complaint is showing how those burdens are discriminatory and how they're being disproportionately experienced along racial lines, color lines, or national origin lines.
And so basically we're fighting this after the fact, and that makes it more challenging than preventing an environmental hazard from coming into the community in the first place.
That's absolutely right. Some of the tactics that we were discussing earlier about staying informed, community organizing, and talking to government decision makers in advance are the best tactics, before a decision gets made. But once a decision gets made that is discriminatory, then Title VI can be an option.
Well, I want to go back to Kamita and Al, because the first thing that now comes to mind is, what about your legislators? I mean, did you have a chance to talk to them, and what did they say? How did they get involved in this process? Because after all, that's, what we elect them for, right?
Yes. We met with our Councilman Mel Franklin before the final approval of the permit for the Panda plant. It was a good meeting, and he was engaged, but his in analysis was there could be arguments from both sides. So it's argument for the power plant saying it's not doing, and then the community saying we need to address these health issues and concerns of the community. At this point, there has been no engagement from our legislators on at any part to engage with the community, and we've had meetings that we have looked for him to be involved in, and that has not happened. They've kind of ran for the hills, and that's been disconcerting, because we're looking for them to say at least, what is it that we can do? And, I told his chief of staff, I said, the part that bothers me, again, and we come back to this, is that there was no concern for the health of the community, and especially when there is a senior population that is sandwiched between these two power plants, where it is known that one is going to emit five times more of the ammonia into the air. And taking in consideration that we're already impacted by other things that are already in the community that affect our water, our air, and that they have no concern for this. We have fly ash, we have nine mining operations, and then that's already been known to contaminate our water and our air.
And, and I want to have you paint another picture regarding these three power plants and give our listeners a more pictorial perspective of what you're dealing with. But before we do that, we do have a caller. We have David from San Francisco. David, you're on the air.
Oh, morning, Patricia, or afternoon for you, I guess.
Absolutely.
I was going to ask a kind of a different question, but since you've got a guest on regarding power plants, I'd wonder I work on energy issues out here in San Francisco, and so we noticed at the time of Enron, this was, 2000, that Dick Cheney had created what was called the Energy Task Force. And so a lot of energy activists, clean air activists, were trying to get the documentation out of that task force, and they were declaring that it was top secret. And to this day, the Cheney Energy Task Force, this is 16, 17 years later, still have not released the nature of them. So I notice up near you, you've got that, you've got a nuclear power plant, and they just want to run a natural gas pipeline within a couple of hundred yards of it, and people are trying to get documents out of that, then they all seem to be secret. So it's, I'm just wondering if your guest is familiar with the problems of getting, documents out of the power companies nowadays, and if they're using top secrecy as some excuse.
Okay, well, let me address that to you, Neil. What do you know about this?
I'm not sure that we know very much about how decisions are being made in the state of Maryland. The decisions that we're talking about are made by the environmental agencies of Maryland. The approvals of these plants, decisions about fracking, about pipelines, and there definitely is a movement in Maryland towards in the current administration towards more gas, more fossil fuel power plants, and that's troubling. And I think it would be helpful to know more about who are the decision makers meeting with? Who are they listening to? Who are they talking to? And we don't know much about that yet, but I think that's a good suggestion.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for calling in, David.
Sure.
We have Edward Parham. Edward, you're on the line. State your question or comment.
I'm coming from a different angle, but I live in the Lavender Road community. Actually, my property is adjacent to the Falstaff Shopping Center. So mine is more of big business versus residential. And I've been here for 13 years, and I continually have to fight with just the cleanliness of that property. And the owners, I've called them, I've solicited to the city council people, I've solicited the mayor's office, and even the city council president, and there has been no resolve. I mean, it's just, and that's just one of my problems, the constant and frequent trash and debris. And when we talk about the condition of the Chesapeake Bay, a lot of that trash and debris, when we have major storms coming from that shopping center, is really a lot. Runs into the drains here. So as a community and as a residential community, we have to face that amongst many things, the infestation of rats, the tenants there and the owners of that property just refuse to cooperate and help us environmentally have a safer and a more conducive neighborhood for both the residential community and for the commercial community.
And so, Neil, is this also considered an environmental hazard?
Yes, absolutely. Whether there is an environmental law to address that issue is another question, but absolutely, those are issues of environmental justice. And they actually, they remind me of some of the problems that Kamita and Al are seeing in Prince George's County around zoning and planning and the siting of new developments, both commercial and residential. Maybe they can say more about that.
Yeah, and before we move on to that, I want to find out, Neil, what makes a case attractive to Earth Justice?
Well, Earth Justice is looking we have limited resources like everyone does, and there's so much need out there. We work across the country on a wide range of environmental issues. So we're looking to make a difference. We're looking for cases where we're going to have a high impact, in addition to helping an individual community, an individual group, or an individual, we're also going to set a precedent that will be useful to other communities and other individuals in future cases. It's increasingly important to us to make sure that environmental justice and equity component is there in the work that we're doing, that we're standing up for disadvantaged communities, partnering with groups that represent those communities.
Okay, and if I could ask Al Weaver to respond. Al, can you address Edward's comment, his concern about how to organize? He's been fighting this for 13 years. If you had to give him any advice regarding how to organize and engage the community to fight this, what would you recommend?
Well, first thing I would recommend also, in Prince George's County, we have something called the 311 line. Do not use that. That would address these concerns. Go directly to the Department of Environment, its leader, Adam Ortiz, and we have something in our county called the Environmental Action Committee. I really would like that gentleman to join that. You will have a voice about what goes on in your community, and you'll get to find out their policy on dealing with commercial businesses with in regard to these issues. Right now, our county is we're so business friendly right now, and history of business friendly, believe it or not, in some areas, in some cases, we're just now adopting recycling policies and environmentally friendly policies in our county after all of these years. So it would behoove you to that gentleman to get in touch with that local government agency, the Department of Environment, and if anyone has it in their community around the country, deal with those people first. Then once you pull the information out of there, because you'll have when you're an activist, you don't just hit people with the problems. You also have to hit them with resources at the same time. Then you come off as more of an authority on the issue, and then you can organize. It really helps you with your organization.
Okay, and Kamita, I'm going to get back to you because I really want to paint the picture about what's going on in your community. But Byron, if you can also quickly tell us what you would recommend people such as Edward, who has an issue in his community, what would HPRC recommend that he do?
Well, yeah, we've heard most of the most important things. I mean, at the county level, there's an environmental function, an office where they deal with environmental issues. There's a health department where they're supposed to look after the health of the public. There is, at the state level, there's a Department of Environmental Quality. But it's useful to begin where you are at the local level and then bump it up to the next level up. So from, say, your municipality to the county, from the county to the state. And in this case, where there are federal civil rights laws impacted, you can go all the way up there if that's where the issue can be best addressed.
Okay, and Kamita, now I'm going to go back to you. Paint this picture for us about what your community is dealing with. You're talking about three power plants. Tell me about the proximity that they are around, next to each other and close to schools. And then I want you to also just tell me how many environmental hazards that you already have in your community. Let's start with the three power plants. Give me an idea of how close they are to one another.
They're within a 2.9-mile radius. If you draw a straight line, they all sit in line with one another.
And how close are they to any of the local schools?
Within that same block of the two power plants.
Like half a mile? A mile?
Yes.
Yeah. And we're talking elementary school?
Yes.
Okay. Now, I understand.
It already has an issue, and when dealing with it, a lot of kids have asthma. In doing our door knocking, a lot of the residents had become diagnosed with asthma. The other issue, we're talking about other environmentals. We have a Dromo site that is the worst in the history of the nation.
What is that called?
It's a Dromo.
Which is?
It's a Superfund site where Andrews Air Force was dumping hazardous toxins.
Okay.
That was kept there. It has a 20-mile plume that is still active. It's not been a closed site. So not only do we have these power plants, but we have the Dromo site with the contamination to the water, which is already an issue because the other thing comes into community science. It's like people are planting gardens, and we have air contamination and water contamination.
Wow. This is not good at all. So tell me, Neil, why is it that we're still dealing with fossil fuel and not embracing clean energy, solar panels and wind turbine, wind tunnels? Why is this still happening?
Well, that's a very good question. You know, the opportunity is there. You know, solar power and wind power at this point are competitive with fossil fuels, and we could transition to them and reap all kinds of benefits for society in terms of health. You know, at very little cost. I think that probably the main reason why we're not moving more quickly in that direction is because of vested interests. You know, there's a lot of money to be made in fossil fuels, and you know, natural gas looks more like oil, it looks more like coal, it uses more similar infrastructure, so sort of the established players are better able to move into that business, whereas something like rooftop solar, that's more of a challenge to the established business model. You know, what that means is that, you know, individuals and communities need to take more of an initiative. They can't necessarily count on, you know, their utilities and big business to take the initiative in embracing these new technologies. And it's going to be up to citizens to get involved and keep pushing.
Okay, I have time for two more questions. One is going to be just having each of you to provide your contact information, whatever you want to share with our listeners. And then I'm going to come back and I'm going to ask Kamita and Al and maybe Neil to let us know where you are in the process, what the next steps are, and what it means in terms of moving forward. So why don't we start with you, Byron, with HPRC. Let us know where the listeners can find you and learn more.
Okay. We are online at hprc.info, and our website has any number of different resources that you can benefit from. And in terms of if there are any of these issues that you're dealing with in your community, our work at HPRC is focused in the Mid-Atlantic, so it's Maryland, DC, Pennsylvania, Delaware, Virginia, West Virginia. So if you're in any of those six states and you have any of these issues, contact us and let us know what you're dealing with so we can see if there are any resources we can direct you to. But first start online, hprc.info.
And there's a contact us portion on your webpage where
yes,
they can email.
Well, yeah, and then all our social media, we're on Twitter, we're on Facebook, we write a blog on every week, and so yeah, there are plenty of resources.
Okay, and why don't you tell us, Neil, where we can find you?
The best way to contact Earth Justice is also by using the contact information on our website, earthjustice.org. You could also Google our tagline, because the Earth needs a good lawyer. Maybe that's easier to remember.
That's catchy. I like that. Okay. Kamita and Al, how can our listeners reach you?
We can be reached at btbcoalition.org. Information's there, and we're also on Facebook for social media.
Okay, and also I will give out my email address, pat@patriciaterrell.com. So if you need to reach them, you can also contact me, and I will help to facilitate the connection. So before we leave, can we take about a minute or two to talk about where you are in the process? You filed the Title VI, I understand. It was accepted by EPA. Tell us where you are and lead us through the process of what happens next. Neil or Al or Kamita, which one of you would like to take that?
Neil would have to answer that.
Okay, go ahead, Neil.
Yeah, so, you know, we filed the complaint, and the Environmental Protection Agency and the Department of Transportation accepted jurisdiction, which means that they think that there are significant issues raised in the complaint and that they need to be investigated. The process doesn't always move quickly, and you know, we hope that that's going to yield a thorough investigation. We hope that we'll be able to talk with the Maryland agencies. You know, ultimately it's the Maryland agencies that made this decision, that should take responsibility for the decision, and they have the power to make things right in Brandywine.
Great. And fortunately, with this temporary win in North Dakota, may be setting the stage for what's yet to come with our local community here.
We hope so.
Okay. Well, we have another caller. We have time for one more caller. Paul from Maine, you're on the air.
I have a possible solution to global warming. What I'm doing is the state of Maine has passed a ruling requiring that utilities pay solar home owners 33 cents a kilowatt hour. So I'm building a 100-panel solar-powered house. And with that, I hope to be able to make $1,000 a month income from solar and then install car charging stations in the basement of the house to charge about 6 electric cars and sell the energy to electric car owners and that way make $1,000 a month.
Okay, well, that sounds like a commercial advertisement.
No, it's not, because this is what Germany has done to shut down all nukes in Germany, and they built 100,000 of these 100-panel solar houses in Germany. And the news is not getting reported in this country.
All right, so here's what we'll do. And I thank you, Paul, and I don't mean to cut you off, but we really want to try to keep it tied to the environmental issue here. And if you want to talk about that issue, leave your name and number with the audio engineer, and I can learn more about what you're saying, and perhaps we can have it on another show. But, Neil, did I miss anything in what Paul was saying that may apply, that I may have overlooked?
Well, I think it just underscores that we have good alternatives to fossil fuels, and that there are lots of creative people out there like Paul who are taking the initiative to lead a transition to clean energy.
Okay. And so, Kamita and Al, what I'd like to do is have the two of you talk about what steps that communities can take, what the process is to engage, and then to take your issue to the proper authorities. I'll start with you, Kamita.
I think that communities first have to understand what community empowerment is at the grassroots level. It's like you were saying, there's a lot of operation at the steps level and parachuting in from people that are not of the community. I can't stress enough that community empowerment at the grassroots level, because what we have to be is confidence, community, inclusive, organized, and cooperative within ourselves to be influential. And that's the part that we're missing, is that we have the power. Nobody has to give us that power. And in taking that empowerment and approach to contribute to the community, that gives us the power to then go to our legislators. So we have to have that part in order to have equity, in order to challenge it, to have a democratic involvement by the people in which our issues that affect our lives, that we then can have the autonomy and the shared power and the skills and knowledge and experience to then change things. I'm real passionate about that, about the grassroots level activism.
Absolutely, and that's where change really happens at that level. Al, what about you? What would you like our listeners to know?
One of the things that got me into being sort of a community activist is getting involved, finding the, doing the research. Research. That should be also on the forefront. Research these issues. Find out why something is occurring. Not just that it's happening. Find out why it's occurring. Pay attention to your planning process. Your planning process, if I couldn't stress anything more, pay attention to the planning process. We're in our county right now. We've lost a beautiful component I call the district council, which gave us the citizens' redress after a project was approved. We're losing that with the zoning rewrite now. So now we have to pay attention on the zoning rewrite on what part are the people going to be involved in? What is our appeal process? How are we going to be participant in the process? And in doing that, that's where you take what Kamita said, you're empowered, you've done the work. Now you bring all that together with the good research. You got a venue in which to speak on. You've created a venue for yourself in your county government. And you talk to these people. And you have to let them understand you elected them.
Right.
You
Absolutely.
Elected them.
And we have 1 minute, I've been told. So thank you so much for that, Al and Kamita. Byron, I'm going to let you have 30 seconds to give some final comments, and then Neil.
Okay. Well, thank you, everyone. Thank you so much for this conversation. It's been very useful, and hopefully we've gotten the word out. Thank you, Patricia, for facilitating it. But, the last thing I'd like to say is what I started with at the beginning, and that is the Federal Clean Power Plan, which is unfortunately tied up in the courts at the moment. But there is a national effort to deal with pollution coming from power plants. And so every state will have to make up their own plan about how to do this. And Neil is right that at the state level, there are things that we can do. So in Maryland and D.C. and Pennsylvania and West Virginia and Delaware and the district, there are things that we can do to get on board with this federal plan once it is finalized. So thanks for the conversation.
Okay, Neil, you have 10 seconds.
Well, I just emphasize that, we're seeing the cost of fossil fuel-fired power in Brandywine just as we see it all across the country, and it's well past time that we address those health issues and transition to clean energy.
Perfect. Thank you, everyone, for joining me today. Okay.
Thank you very much, Patricia.
Thank you.
You
thank
bet.
Thank you. Thank you.
And thank you to our callers. And be sure to tune in next Saturday for more lively discussions about how you can make positive changes in your life.
The research and information that we report during today's broadcast was supported by the National Institute on Minority Health and Health Disparities of the National Institutes of Health under award number 5U54MD00860802. The content is solely the responsibility of the authors and does not necessarily represent the official views of the National Institutes of Health.
Remember to tune in to Make the Change every Saturday from 12 noon p.m. Eastern Standard Time. You can also visit with Patricia at www.patriciaterrell.com for links to social media, email, and blogs. Thank you for listening today, and remember that changing the world starts with changing you.
If you live in Prince George's County, Maryland, listen up for this important announcement about how you can gain access to resources that can improve your health. The Health Policy Research Consortium, also known as HPRC, has a mobile app called Health Connect Prince George's that can help you find local resources such as farmers markets, parks and hike trails, recreation centers, community health centers, hospitals, pharmacies, and much more. The Health Connect Prince George's app is available for download on Google Play and the iTunes App Store. You can also visit www.hprc.info. That's www.hprc.info and click the links at the bottom of the page. Download the Health Connect app today to connect you and your community to a healthier tomorrow.